morning. My name is Michael McCusker. 84 years ago today, on August 2nd, 1934, Adolf Hitler became Führer of Germany at the death of General Paul Hindenburg, who had been president. Chancellor Hitler absorbed the presidency and moved into total power as absolute dictator. The German army pledged an oath of loyalty to Hitler, the person, as well as Führer, and the last remnants of democracy in the form of a collapsed Weimar Republic that had replaced the monarchy of Kaiser Wilhelm at the loss of World War I in 1918 were dismantled. Hitler immediately began purging enemies within, which included inside the ranks of his Nazi party. And from the beginning of his savage reign of war and Holocaust, terror and injustice, the Jewish religion was the foremost enemy and victim of the Nazi state. A song German school children sang in the Nazi thousand-year Reich that lasted only a dozen years exemplified Hitler's total control of Germany in the 1930s. For Hitler we live, for Hitler we die. Our Hitler is our Lord, who rules our brave new world. Substitute the name of Trump 84 years and a newer millennium later, and our own self-designated Führer would orgy himself. The essential question about unrelenting tyrants is how to be rid of them, especially when they defy every reasonable and lawful method of dismissal. Should they be removed forcibly by military or law enforcement officials, sanctioned by court or legislative decree, short of a coup or political revolt? And if that is improbable, would assassination be a valid consideration? Assassination of presidents and other public officials is a forbidden subject in the USA. Even the thought of it is a criminalized act, much less expression of it. Yet the world might have suffered less if such monsters as Hitler, Stalin, Idi Amin, Saddam Hussein, Antonio Duterte were to have been done away with before they reached their maximums of depravity. Much has been said of being rid of Donald Trump. No sense pretending it hasn't been thought about. One especially self-expressed rock-ribbed Republican said Trump should be shot. But that might paradoxically martyr him. It has been conjectured that Trump might better serve the absolutist goals of his gurus if he were indeed martyred. Speculation about the ruthless response to an assassination attempt against Trump, successful or not, elicits a probable declaration of martial law nationwide by his equally autocratic and rigidly Calvinistic vice president, Mike Pence, with massive roundups of the usual suspects in grim Orwellian panache. But there are other options for personal acts against repugnance. After all, what is more mainstream Americana than a solid punch in the nose, which would be well-deserved and deliciously appropriate for such trumped-up trumpery that spews from the Trumpian mouth at least half a dozen times daily? He glosses over his self-serving deceit by claiming he thinks, speaks, and acts from his gut instinct. Would that be his gluttonous addiction to cheeseburgers and junk food? If a punch in the nose might seem too passionate a disavowal to Trumpavalian dupery, a pie in the face would certainly be a hilarious alternative and no less inspirationally Yankee Doodle than a jab to the snozzle. The Trump resistance could actually form guerrilla pie-throwing brigades to show up at his public appearances, especially at his many quasi-fascist rallies of jittering malevolence. Eugene McCarthy, once a candidate for the presidency to end the iniquitous and increasingly unpopular Vietnam War 50 years ago, might have been speaking of Trump when he described a Republican colleague in Congress. He has the kind of courage of a soldier who observes the battlefield from a hill and then rides down to shoot the enemy's wounded men. Or consider Hunter S. Thompson's eloquent portrayal of Richard M. Nixon as a foul caricature of himself, a man with no soul, no inner convictions, with the integrity of a hyena and the style of a poisoned toad, with apologies to said creatures. Donald Trump, who compounded his usual racism by disparaging most of humanity as animals without including the single race of albino whites, Homo sapiens is, after all, an animalistic creature, shows himself in almost every conceivable manner to be a vicious and vindictive person whose only concept of integrity or morality, even his strained sense of justice, is that which benefits him and which perversely justifies for him any malodorous act to gain those personal ends. His behavior as president is proof positive. He might be contemptible enough to spit upon and vicious enough to extract very dark revenge. His swaggering venality has affected us all. A corrupt, compulsively dishonest, schemingly elected president who lost the majority vote despite his fake self-Twitter as a beloved father Führer. His arrogant and recklessly delusionary seizure of power as though he were a king rather than only a president has spread deceit, avarice, and corruption throughout American culture. Not that it wasn't already flagrant, along with the pervasive racism he encourages and defends. About Trump, Walter Kerr might have had his measure when he spoke of someone else. He had delusions of adequacy. Or Paul Keating. He is simply a shiver for a spine to run up. It will probably take a great while to repair the damage to democracy by Donald Trump's attempt to both buffoonishly and menacingly set himself up as American Führer. Yet everyone should be aware of the chilling future without constitutional democracy, imperfect though it certainly is, and susceptible to zealotry, corruption, discriminations of every sort, and of course, always infested with homegrown tyrants and outlandish conspiracies that too often turn ugly. We might, after all, be a dying democracy, a bloated red dwarf star that rose too quickly and consumed itself with careless and misguided hubris mixed with the black holes of anxiety and hatred. Whatever greatness we have possessed, which has been our hardship quest for liberty and justice for ordinary people, seems to be swiftly disintegrating. And at least from the vantage of things as they are now, the torch of human rights and liberty is threatened with extinguishing, personified by Trump's Sturm und Drang grasp for his own piece of Hitler. If indeed we do succumb to a ridiculously pompastic caricature of the historically criminal Boss Tweed of Tammany Hall infamy, whom cartoonist Thomas Nast artfully lampooned 150 years ago, it might be hoped that a future people will more successfully struggle against similar despotism and oppression and redefine liberty, equality, and justice. And that is something I wrote, and I bear the rap of it. And now, from T.J. Stiles, who wrote this for the New York Times, the constitutional amendment that reinvented freedom. This past Saturday, July 28th, marked the 150th anniversary of the Constitution as we know it, the glorious, flawed, unexpected moment when our basic law was transformed into a Charter of Human Rights. Its glories define us, but so do its flaws. I refer to the 14th Amendment, whose ratification was certified on July 28, 1868. It shapes almost every issue we debate today: immigration, racial and gender equality, voter suppression, free speech, corporations, and federal power. Its history destroys the notion that freedom grew steadily over time, that the founders bestowed liberty on white men, which was gradually extended to others. Rather, the amendment reinvented freedom. It established birthright citizenship, required due process and equal protection of the law, and those are in quotes, for everyone, and put the federal government in the business of policing liberty. It removed race and ethnicity from the legal definition of American identity. Before the 14th Amendment, the Bill of Rights protected almost no one. In Barron versus Baltimore, Chief Justice John Marshall wrote for a unanimous Supreme Court in 1833 that those original amendments restrained only the federal government, not the states, and so did not guarantee individual freedoms. Through the incorporation doctrine, the 14th Amendment made the Bill of Rights apply to the states, giving those First Amendments the powerful role they play today. And we owe this monumental amendment to the self-assertion of Black people. It is often called one of the Civil War amendments, along with the 13th, abolishing slavery, and the 15th, prohibiting racial limits on the right to vote. But almost no one anticipated such a far-reaching measure during the war, or even after the Confederacy collapsed in May 1865. In 1860, four free states had constitutional prohibitions on the immigration of Black people across their borders. In 1865, only five of 20 Union states allowed Black men to vote. A race-neutral definition of citizenship and individual rights, let alone Black enfranchisement, seemed absurd to most white men. A political crisis driven by African Americans changed everything. During the war, they defied white expectations by starting what the historian Stephen Hahn calls the greatest slave rebellion in history, seizing on the upheaval of war to flee and fight for freedom. Afterward, they asserted themselves in ways large and small, from picking their own surnames to insisting on equal dignity, especially in the case of former Union soldiers. They went further, organizing conventions, political clubs, union leagues. The federal superintendent of Negro Affairs in North Carolina remarked in astonishment at how people who had been kept uneducated by force formed societies, leagues, combinations, meetings, with little of routine or record, but much of speech-making and sage counsel. And that was a quote. They flooded Congress and military headquarters with petitions and appeals for aid. It prompted a backlash. Southern states passed Black codes that virtually re-enslaved African Americans. Confederate veterans killed countless people and organized into the Ku Klux Klan and similar groups. Deadly police riots in Memphis and New Orleans in 1866 began with attacks on Black veterans and political activists. This oppression overturned Northern assumptions. Even unapologetically racist voters and politicians reacted with outrage. Here were rebels, seen as traitors, attacking loyal Black people, including many Union veterans. Something had to be done. Specifically, something had to be done to stop President Andrew Johnson. The stubborn and insulting Johnson, Lincoln's successor, sided with the White South, which drove Congress to pass the first Civil Rights Act over his veto. The battle led Republicans to conclude that the Constitution itself had to be changed. The result touched far more than the newly emancipated. Before the Civil War, states had restricted speech and the press, often singling out abolitionist literature, imposed religious and racial tests for voting, and funded Christian denominations. Connecticut and Massachusetts established official state churches for many years. One of the 14th Amendment's drafters, John A. Bingham, seized the moment to stop this, declaring his intention, quote, to arm the Congress of the United States by the consent of the people with power to enforce the Bill of Rights, unquote. The constitutional scholar, Akhil Reed Amar, argues that the framers' comments show how even the Second Amendment must be read in light of the 14th. All in all, this was a revolution, a broad reimagining of individual rights and federal power. But if white Americans reconstructed the law, they did not reconstruct themselves. Bigotry suffused the debate and infiltrated the amendment itself. In a half step toward enfranchising the freed people, the 14th Amendment penalizes states that withhold the vote from male citizens, the first use of that adjective in the Constitution. The historian Joshua Pattison notes how Western congressmen complained that ethnic Chinese would become citizens, stating that heathens had no place here. The 14th framers replied that birthright should apply to all and that restrictions in naturalization law would minimize the problem. Asians became a lasting focus of nativist obsession over immigration, seen in the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. Prejudice diluted the 14th Amendment's results. As Adam Winkler writes in We the Corporations, for many decades, the Supreme Court gave greater protection under the amendment to corporations than to African Americans. After the federal government allowed Southern white violence to overwhelm Reconstruction, the justices allowed segregation in Plessy versus Ferguson and in Korematsu versus United States, the imprisonment of American citizens solely for their Japanese ancestry. And the justices first embraced the incorporation doctrine only in 1925 in Gitlow versus New York, the case of a revolutionary socialist who had been arrested for advocating the overthrow of the government, showing again that it takes dissenters and outsiders to expand freedom for all. The 14th Amendment is felt by all of us every day. If it did not invent freedom, it transformed and strengthened it, codifying a universal definition of individual rights and national identity that has been an example to the world. But the failings of those who wrote it linger on. Many of us still have not internalized the idea that an American can look like anyone in the world. Whoever calls the police on a peaceful, unarmed black or brown person is acting in a long, grim tradition. Complaints about immigration of Muslims, Latin Americans, or people from bunghole countries restate the original arguments against the 14th as opening the doors to heathens and pagans. Even debates over the intrusiveness of the federal government and the rights of corporations are rooted in the amendment that forever altered Washington's role in American life. The Americans of 150 years ago created something greater than their own limitations. Yet the law does not enforce itself. It is a tool used by human beings. Over and over again, Americans have thrown it to the ground, sometimes in the midst of praising it. At this moment, the question is not whether we will pick it up again, but whether we will break it. And that was by T.J. Stiles, The Constitutional Amendment That Reinvented Freedom. He has received the National Book Award for Nonfiction and the Pulitzer Prize twice for biography and most recently for history for Custer's Trials, A Life on the Frontier of a New America. He is currently writing a biography of Theodore Roosevelt and wrote this for the New York Times. And now, by Elizabeth Bruning, America's Heart of Darkness. Before he ventures into the depths of the Belgian colonized Congo in Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, the novel's narrator, English sailor Charles Marlowe, visits a doctor who is only meant to declare him fit for travel. But the doctor has other interests, namely insanity. "Ever any madness in your family?" he asks Marlowe, suggesting it may set in out there. As indeed it does, deep in the jungle where European officers and ivory traders have wrought vast and senseless savagery in the supposed service of Western civilization. Marlowe's is a civic kind of going mad, where the veil is lifted from politics and what lies beneath makes participation in ordinary political life with a quiet mind impossible. By the time he returns, what once seemed placid and unremarkable seems sinister and false, and it is. we are about there, I think. Perhaps not every single one of us, perhaps not just yet, but the conditions are right and the summer is long. The entire 2016 episode has been, in some sense, an introspective journey into America's own innermost parts, with Donald Trump's victory prompting a nervous self-inventory of what we value, whether our institutions work, and to what degree we ought to trust one another. The full contents of that inward odyssey have yet to unfold, but on the question of institutional functioning, the news is unequivocally grim. Like Marlowe, even after this particular chapter has ended, we are likely to find ourselves changed by what we have seen. There is the obvious side of the scandal. Russia clearly took steps to interfere with the 2016 presidential election, and to some incalculable extent, probably succeeded. It appears to have meddled by way of dirty persuasion, purchasing, somewhat bizarre, anti-Clinton Facebook ads, launching, truly bizarre, pro-Trump Twitter bots, and the piece de resistance, hacking into several Democratic National Committee members' email accounts and publishing thousands of missives on WikiLeaks. Trump's campaign may or may not have been actively involved in the plot to scuttle Hillary Clinton's chances. Maybe the plot wouldn't have gone so well if it were. President Trump may or may not believe Russia interfered whatsoever. His mind changes day to day, and Trump may or may not have won anyway. All of that is secondary. The primary things are these. It just wasn't that hard for a foreign power to tinker with our democratic process, which suggests that it just isn't that hard, full stop, for anyone to tinker with our deliberative democratic process. And if Trump's campaign played along, those who benefited when he won don't really seem to mind. Republicans will issue all sorts of official-sounding tweets and news releases decrying the subversion of America's hallowed institutions, but they've got their tax cuts and Supreme Court seats, and they're not going to initiate impeachment proceedings or primary Trump come 2020. A neutral observer couldn't be blamed for concluding that the rich and powerful people who contend for control of the country don't much care how public offices wind up in their hands, so long as they do. And this is true across the board. Those emails the Russians loosed upon the electorate were damning precisely because they revealed a similar scheme operating in miniature during the Democratic primary campaign. The supposedly neutral DNC functioned as more or less a Clinton campaign organ, subsisting off Clinton campaign funds and musing behind the scenes about targeting then primary contender Bernie Sanders for being a secular Jew. How best to discipline his campaign for complaining about the DNC's partiality, and, ironically, how to properly dispel the appearance of a DNC conspiracy against Sanders. The gravity and legality of the two exercises in meddling differ, certainly, but they both operate to wound our faith in democratic legitimacy. It has gone this way before. It took several incidents, from Vietnam to Watergate, to scattered episodes of civil unrest, to permanently damage American trust in government. But as distinct as each event was, they all fractured the same essential faith. We have not returned to consistent levels of pre-1970s levels of trust in 40 years, and I doubt this current civic unease will fade much sooner. This particular horror, Trump and his failures, whatever ridiculous thing he has said or done today, whatever international incident he causes on Twitter tomorrow, however authentic the next panic is, will pass. What will last is the frank revelation of a point that, while ugly and dark, is at least true. You really don't have the choices you ought to in American society, because of decisions made without your consent by people of wealth and power behind closed doors. It is possible to continue to participate in a democracy after that, but not with a quiet mind. And that was America. America's Heart of Darkness by Elizabeth Bruning, who wrote this for the Washington Post, of which she is a reporter. And this is Michael McCusker.